Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a conversation with the co-creator of a Peabody-winning HBO series, and how and why immigration stories are connecting with media consumers in new ways. But first, this week on the show's Culture Cap. It is Fan Fusion Week here in Phoenix, the annual gathering of pop culture icons and their fans. This year's event will feature appearances by performers from the world of fantasy film and TV shows, comics, and comics that have been adapted into fantasy film and TV shows. We're talking people like Elijah Wood, who played Frodo Baggins in the Lord of the Rings films, Hayden Christensen from the Star Wars prequels, and Brent Spiner, better known as Data on Star Trek. One of the hallmarks of fan fusion is people dressing up like their favorite fictional characters. It is just one of the ways that events like Fan Fusion and the various online communities where fans gather to celebrate imaginary worlds create this kind of liminal space for conversations and interactions that can't really happen anywhere else. And joining us this morning to talk about why those spaces matter are Nasha Smith, a professor and PhD student at the Cronkite School of Journalism. Good morning, Nasha.
Good morning.
And Kim Holst, a clinical professor of law and also a PhD student at Cronkite. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you.
So I wanted to start by asking you both about your personal fandoms, because you're not just experts in this, you're also fans yourselves. So Kim, let's start with you. What's something that you consider yourself to be a fan of?
Sure. So I have become a Swiftie. I didn't start out a Swiftie. My daughter was a Swiftie. And then just, I would say, over the course of the years leading up to Reputation, I got pulled into that fandom. And it is a community that is very interesting and very varied. And so I now proudly own that I'm a Swiftie.
Okay. Can you think of any kind of pivotal moment? Was it just sort of a gradual slide into Swiftiedom? Or?
That's a great question. So I think I was a fan of her music. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed listening to it, but I didn't know that much about her. My daughter was obsessed with all of the Easter eggs and things that Swifties love. And so I kind of got pulled into it. But I really have to say it was when she did release the Reputation album and the way that was rolled out and all of the things that she did to include her fans in the rollout of that is really what pulled me in. It was like there was a connection between Taylor Swift and me as a fan.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're definitely going to talk more about that. Nasha, how about you?
Oh, I don't think we have enough time for my fandoms, but so twofold, because I'm a massive sports fan and a massive entertainment fan. I'm a huge New York Yankees fan, super fan for sure. I will travel to New York for the games. I am in probably every Yankee fan space, subreddit everywhere, and musicians. I love music. I'm an OG Eminem stan from the beginning, from the late 90s. I adore you too. Like growing up in St. Lucia as a child, that was rare.
Uh-huh.
You know, rock music, we're more into like calypso, soca. So I was definitely an anomaly, but I adored you too. And I love the Killers. I consider myself a victim and I have seen them multiple times.
Is that what Killers fans call themselves?
Unfortunately, yes.
Okay.
But we're just, you know, it's not the best, but we're just going to roll with it.
Okay, so we have Swifties, victims, stans,
yes.
Already a number of kind of in-group language frameworks that are kind of a part of what we're going to talk about today. So let's back up a second and talk about fan fusion and what events like this represent and kind of why they matter in fandom spaces. Kim, let me start with you on this. Talk a little bit about why a real-world gathering of like-minded folks is significant.
Yeah, I think for a lot of reasons, people have felt isolated, obviously in recent times because of the pandemic. But I think, when you have this thing that you know other people really enjoy, there's some fulfillment in being able to contact them online. But when you get to see people in person and you get to feel that energy of somebody who's just as excited or more excited than you are about that same topic, you form these connections. And part of one of the reasons why this kind of fandom has really blown up is I think people really have allowed it to be part of their identity. They find some kind of resonance, whether it's emotional or cultural, et cetera, and they adopt that identity. And I think that's true definitely even in the sports space, as Nasha was talking about, the entertainment space, and being able to find people that have that identity just like you is a bonding experience that I think is akin to, you know, going to a stadium and having that live experience with like-minded fans.
Nasha, do you accept that sports comparison?
Oh, absolutely. Especially, again, I always have to bring in my experience from St. Lucia because, like I said, I'm a Yankees fan. We don't have baseball in St. Lucia. So I was really solitary in my fandom. It was very difficult for there weren't other people for me to connect with. So when I moved to the U.S. for school and I finally went to a Yankees game, it was just so eye-opening for me and so refreshing because I finally had, you know, at home people would entertain me by, they would listen to me talk about, but meeting other people who had, you know, they shared the same grievances, they were excited about the same things, the same players. There's nothing like finally finding your family, you know, outside of your regular family. You know, that community is just so important because depending geography, you know, is not the only way to find community.
Yeah.
Sometimes you need these people that shared experience, and you can't, depending on where you are, you can't always find that within, you know, your area. So it is something like a fan fusion. It makes sense because you have sometimes very niche interests that no one else will understand. And then when you meet and you connect with those people, who you feel seen. You feel like finally somebody understands, somebody cares about what I'm talking about.
Like they recognize the amount of detail you put into that costume, or, you know, things that your family is like, oh, yeah, that's nice. They're humoring you and supporting you. But like that person who recognizes it, that spark, that moment is like so much more meaningful.
Even if you disagree, you feel like at least you know what I'm talking about, and we can have meaningful conversation about this.
There's a starting point for the disagreement.
Yes.
That is a shared love and passion. You also said something really important there, Nasha, that I don't want to let go by, which is you were very fortunate to have a family that was like, okay, Nasha, tell us about the Yankees. You know, we will listen and nod and smile. We're happy you've found this thing, I guess. There's a difference between being, I'll use the word, tolerated in that sense, and the kind of experience you might have at Yankee Stadium, say, or at Fan Fusion, where it's not toleration, it's tolerance, it's recognition, even sometimes literally embrace. Like one of my favorite things about going to, I'm a big Baltimore Orioles fan, so I don't know if we can actually be friends, Nasha, I'm so sorry.
I think not, but for now.
For now, yes. I will go to games at Oriole Park at Camden Yards, and if something good or bad happens, I will turn to the person next to me and just hug them. Or they will turn to me and just like have tears in their eyes and be like, can you believe what just happened? And it doesn't feel weird. It doesn't feel weird. And there's something very, I'll say healthy, I think, about that space. Kim, would you agree?
I definitely agree. And I think there's something in that, like, that shared knowledge of a topic where you can jump into a conversation that other people, you have to explain and give them all the background, and they're not invested. Where, like, if, you know, I'm a Minnesota Vikings fan because I grew up there, and, like, you're, like, the 1998 playoffs. And, like, that's all you have to say, and just everybody knows exactly what that is and, like, that pain and everything. Like, they share that experience with you. And there is something about that that's just like, ah, yes, I can be comfortable and relax and have this conversation, and I don't have to explain every single thing and why that's why that matters, why it's important.
Yeah. You know, as we're talking about this, I'm reminded of the joke you see online sometimes when we talk about sports fans, where sports fans will sit around and play the game that gets referred to as, quote, let's remember some guys, where, you know, you just sit with some sports fans and you say, like, the 98 playoffs. And it's, you know, it sometimes gets made fun of online, I think, as, look at these people, they can't talk about their emotions. But I think what's actually going on in those moments is there's an emotional shorthand. There's the barrier is already down, and you know the code word to just get into this deep well of feeling that only makes sense, Nasha, as you were putting it, to your family.
Absolutely. And I think of it, this type of fandom also sort of transcends generations.
Yes.
Because
yes.
I teach teenagers a lot of the time. And last semester, I literally mentioned the 2004 incident. And my three young Yankee fans in the class were immediately like, oh my God, because they knew. And, you know, we all grew up at different points. I'm significantly older than them, but we had that connection immediately.
Yeah.
And it's just such a wonderful thing. You don't have to. This is truly where your age, all these things, you know, the fandom transcends that.
Right, right.
It's really humanizing.
Like, yes.
Oh, you're not just the professor at the front of the room. You have these experiences that I can relate to.
Absolutely. So lest we veer too far into sports talk here, I want to make a difference, I think, and tell me if you both disagree, between sports fandom, which I think in a broad context is more acceptable, and the kind of fandoms we find at something like FanFusion, where we're talking about what is often shorthanded as geek culture. Kim, what do you think the important differences are there?
Yeah, well, I think that I agree. I think sports fandom and sports kind of being invested in the team has always been a lot more acceptable. I don't have any literature to back this up, you know, offhand, but I do think there's something about that kind of hetero-masculine group of people in the, you know, typical sports fandom that somehow makes that more acceptable. Whereas, as you described it, like this geek culture, kind of the people who felt like outcasts, people who are marginalized, I think often find themselves in these types of fan situations a lot more comfortable. They found people who have similar interests that are maybe not mainstream interests. And so I think that the development of some of these fan communities has largely started with marginalized people as opposed to people who are part of kind of a mainstream fandom.
Nasha, do you think that is why something like fan fusion might be particularly resonant for fans of things like comics, because it's maybe a little harder to find common language with folks in the quote-unquote real world?
Absolutely. Something like comics, you know, it's really niche for some people. And honestly, that type of fandom was traditionally mocked, traditionally, you know, really derided. So something like fan fusion is very important because this is where, again, you can come to find people who are aligned with you. You find people who will engage in conversation with you. You find your people. You find your home. And it is very important because, like Kim was talking about, it is a lot of marginalized people, a lot of people who have sort of felt maybe isolated by their fandom, especially depending on how deep the fandom goes.
Yeah.
Because some people do make this part of their identity, and it does sort of isolate them from just regular people.
Right.
Who don't have these interests.
Yeah.
So something like fan fusion, where you can feel, they're dressing up.
Yes, right.
You know, and they're going all out in the dressing up. They get to listen to these panels. They get to meet these people. It really is the place where you can probably feel you're most comfortable in that fandom.
And I think a lot of those stories resonate.
Well, let me cut you off for just a moment, Kim, because I want to get much more into this. We have to take a momentary break. We'll be back in just a moment here on the show's Culture Cap. Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman, and this is our Culture Cap conversation. We're talking about fandom this morning with Nasha Smith and Kim Holst. And Kim, just before the break, you were starting to talk about the nature of fandom, particularly in quote-unquote geek culture communities.
Right. Well, so Nasha was talking about how lots of these comic book fans and things like that were kind of derided or made fun of. And I think one of the reasons why this type of fan space is really important is because they've identified not only with each other, but with the characters that they are fans of, the ones that they dress up as and things like that. They see the kind of redemption arcs or the hero arcs that they have. And I think that being able to, you know, kind of play out that fantasy in a space where other people accept it and aren't like, you are not Spider-Man. They're like, no, that is, you're the best Spider-Man. You know, I think is also an important part of it.
Right. Well, and that makes me think about the fact, and Nasha, tell me if you agree, that a lot of times the characters that fans resonate with are social outcasts, people who were born with some sort of physical or emotional weakness. Somebody like Spider-Man is a great example. Until he was bit by this radioactive spider, he was just kind of a geek, if you will. And then now all of a sudden he gets this arc of redemption and he gets to kind of step into his full self. Nasha, do you think that's fair to say that a lot of this has to do with a kind of emotional resonance with the journey of the characters?
Absolutely. I think, first of all, we do love a relatable character. We like someone we can see ourselves in, and somebody that we can kind of take that journey with, even if it sort of gives you hope. Because you're, especially when you think of kids who have been bullied, when you think of people who have sort of been outcasts, when they see that eventually there's the hero arc, you do eventually get that redemption. You can rebuild yourself. You can change your life. You can do that. It carries them through. It sort of kind of gives them that hope, that something to look forward to in the future. And it does resonate with them. We do like to relate to, whether it's a character, whether it's our favorite artist, we do like something where we can find a connection with that person.
But can I ask you, just to go back to the sports context for a moment, I hadn't thought about this until we got onto this line of conversation, but I'm curious what you think, Nasha. I mean, when you watch somebody like, say, Aaron Judge, who plays for the Yankees, or, you know, in my case, for the Orioles, it would probably be Gunnar Henderson. These are people who I have nothing in common with. They are extraordinary physical specimens. Their skill level is elite in a way that is sort of impossible for me to even think about. And that doesn't bother me at all. I still feel this kind of connection to them, which strikes me as kind of a critical difference here.
Absolutely. But I think in sports as well, there's a difference there in that we just want to be adjacent sometimes to that power. When, you know, as a Yankee fan, yes, I can boast to other people that my player, my team, we have that kind of power. We are, you know, they call them the evil empire for the longest while because they were so dominant. And I love that because, I mean, I have literally not a share in the Yankees. But as a fan, I feel like I am 100%. This is a we situation.
Right, you're
us.
Part of the team when you're a sports fan. You're not on the field, but you're an important part of what makes them successful. They can't do without the fans kind of mentality. So
true.
You're like part of it. So even
I
though
I'm part of their power.
Yes, exactly.
You're
part of the evil empire.
You're part of the evil.
I am part of their power. I am, you know, continuing the conversations about them when they get off the field offline, because, you know, it's why we feel. I mean, I'm still here. Depressed over the fifth inning of Game 5 of the World Series. You know, we feel that loss as deeply as we feel that jubilation when our team has conquered. So I feel like I can't relate to not one of these men.
Yeah.
But I feel adjacent to that kind of power. I feel like we're in this together. And when they succeed, almost like I have been successful as well.
Yes, yes. Well, I'm curious to get both of your takes on this. I mean, we're talking about fandom in part because there's this giant event happening downtown that, you know, thousands of people are going to come to. The tickets are very expensive. It's something that, as you were pointing out, Nasha, crosses generations. People come with their kids and everything. It's like, you know, not just young people, it's parents. It seems like, again, broadly speaking, we're living in a time when it's cool to be a fan. But that was not always the case, right?
Right, for sure. I mean, if you think back to when Elvis became big or the Beatles became big and you saw them on TV, all the screaming fans, you know, the media was calling them crazy. We're like, oh, they're crazed and, you know, we need to be concerned about their deviant behavior. and today, you know, when I see the fans walking to Fan Fusion, because I work in downtown Phoenix, I'm like, they're just headed to Fan Fusion. Right. I don't immediately think, wow, there are people dressed in like alien costumes or, you know, whatever it is. And right. I should probably call someone because they clearly need help. It is definitely more accepted than it was. And I think part of that is because a lot of the artists, the entertainers, et cetera, have really bought into fan culture in a way that I don't think existed before. And I probably would credit social media with a lot of this, that there's a lot more connection between artists and fans. But, you know, there was a time when people were writing things like fan fiction, and some artists were like, no, stop. That's my creative material. And now you get people who are like, oh, share that, please. I'm putting that out there. I want to be part of this.
Yeah. Nasha, I know this is something you've thought about a lot. There is this idea that fans are in some ways kind of the new cultural critics.
They are. Going off of Kim's point, artists definitely want to have, it's almost like having your own army, your own little defense. To be fair, Adele's people, I believe, are called Adele's army, but I'm BTS army as well. So you do have that defense. But yes, the fans have now become the new cultural critics. And you see that even in traditional journalism. And for example, you can't, if you go back and you just read, you know, traditionally journalism, music criticism was very objective, but now you will read, say, a Justin Timberlake album review, and 3/4 of that review references his relationship with Britney Spears because it's been written by a Britney Spears super fan. And you see a clear delineation between fans of Cardi B and Nicki Minaj and how they, you know, it's almost like you can't be a crossover fan anymore. You have to pick your side and you need to stick with that. But the fans are not the ones who are, I suppose, are the arbiters of taste. They're the ones who people are hardly looking to music, traditional music critics anymore. It's the fans, it's the TikToks, you have leaders in these fan groups. You have leaders in the Beehive, leaders in the Swiftie space.
Right. These are Beehive is Beyonce fans, for those who aren't aware.
For the uninitiated. But you have these people who kind of, you know, and to Taylor Swift's credit, she was one of these people who really early on cultivated that kind of fan base, where she would have sleepovers for fans to have a first listen. So you had these people who had the privilege of, they've gotten to listen to this, so they're now coming to share with the rest of the group. Listen, I've heard this. This is what it is. So they're driving the conversation now, as opposed to, I mean, this is why a lot of them, you know, super fans are now, the studios are now having them interview the stars. They're having them interview the talent, as opposed to just the traditional entertainment journalists.
I'm curious to know, I mean, from both of your standpoints, do you think we lose anything by dint of erasing that objective, as you were putting it, Nasha, boundary? Do you think there's a way in which the conversation becomes maybe more passionate but less nuanced?
Absolutely. It's, first of all, you're losing ethics.
Well, those.
You're losing ethics, you're losing objectivity, you're losing just the traditional practices of journalism. There is something to be said for having gone through some kind of journalism training and knowing how to talk about certain issues surrounding certain artists, and how to, you don't necessarily have to be, you can be honest without it bordering on toxicity.
Yes.
And that's, I think, the problem with the fans now driving this. Because, again, when you have people who have maybe a fandom that has a passionate opposition to... Because that's the thing. It's almost as if that person is impeding their fave's progress or their fave's success.
Right.
So they cannot be complimentary.
Yeah.
You can only have one female rap artist.
Right.
Essentially. And well, so if I support Cardi, I'm not truly supporting Nicki. That's the mentality. And that's where you kind of lose the plot.
Well, there is so much more to talk about here, but we are unfortunately out of time this morning. So I will say to Nasha Smith and Kim Holst, thank you both so much for joining us on this week's Culture Cap.
Thank you. Thanks
thank
for, having,
for
us.
Having us.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, what it takes to create art that imitates life in all its imperfection.
I wanted something that was a reflection of the way I see my life, like with my friends. You know, you laugh, you cry, you know, you fart, all of it.
We will hear more on how actress and writer Bridget Everett uses her own experiences to explore truth without shame in her HBO series, Somebody Somewhere. But first, News of the Trump administration's policies, including its immigration and deportation policies, have been all over the mainstream news, from newspapers to TV and radio. But our next guest says, stories about people being deported and being wrongly deported have also started to appear in non-traditional news outlets as well, which often reach a different audience. Adrian Carrasquillo writes the Huddled Masses newsletter, which focuses on immigration, at The Bulwark. He spoke with my co-host, Mark Brody, to talk more about what he's seen. And they started with what first caught Carrasquillo's attention to the fact that media outlets that might not normally talk about immigration-related stories were talking about them, and were maybe talking about them in a different way than they would have before.
When you have a beat and when you are covering something day in and day out, there are times where you're like, wow, I'm surprised this isn't breaking through. You know, wow, I would have thought that this story would have gotten more attention, and it kind of like dropped like a log, you know. And then there are times that you see, for example, Guantanamo Bay started up. The Trump administration was sending men to Guantanamo Bay that they said were gang members. And we actually had access to focus groups where people who had supported Trump, they had been like Biden 2020 and then Trump 2024 supporters. And I noticed early on that they did not like the Guantanamo Bay stuff. So that was sort of like the first data point for me. And I kept an eye on that. So then when El Salvador started up, I realized that this was along those same lines. And so I think the first moment that I saw it breaking through was Joe Rogan. You know, Joe Rogan famously sort of like the interview with Kamala Harris never happened. Mm-hmm. And he is, you know, the 8,000-pound gorilla, and everybody after the election was talking about how Democrats need their own Joe Rogan and things like that. And so for him to say that, you know, it's horrific that you know, an innocent gay hairdresser was lumped in with the gang members, that really made me take notice. Okay, wow, something's happening here.
Well, it's interesting. Reading your description of that incident kind of reminded me of the very famous moment during the Vietnam War when Walter Cronkite came back from a trip to Vietnam and was fairly critical of the war effort on the air. And reportedly, anyway, Lyndon Johnson, who was president at the time, said, if we've lost Cronkite, mm-hmm. we've lost America. It does not seem, though, as though this is a if we've lost Rogan, we've lost America mm-hmm. kind of situation.
Yeah. And sometimes when I speak to Democrats and, you know, they sort of are concerned, I'll speak to lawmakers and they'll say, wow, if we're 4 or 5 months in, what's going to be happening 2-3 years in? But then along those same lines, then they say, well, what do you expect to be going on? You know, do you think this is going to hurt the Trump administration in 2026 election? I think they think it will. And I don't think that they think the Trump administration cares that much. I mean, they've got this view of how they want to carry out immigration and how punitive they want to be. And they're doing it, sort of everything else be damned.
What do you think all of this says about the kind of power that maybe non-traditional media outlets might have mm-hmm. in impacting politics, political discourse, and maybe even political actions?
Oh, 100%. I mean, you know, I've covered immigration and Latino politics basically my whole career. And, you know, one of the foundational stories that I would hear about, you know, Cesar Chavez back, you know, with his labor movement, the farm workers would be that it wasn't that, again, like I sort of used the example that I use in the story. It's not that this is like in the New York Times or the Washington Post that makes it cut through to every American. The stuff with Cesar Chavez was that suburban housewives and mothers were in the supermarket and were sort of realizing, oh, wait, I get my grapes. The farm workers are the ones that get the produce to the supermarket. And so that sort of, you know, kind of cut through. And so I think that those are kind of the important moments, and it has to get to, you know, when stories get to a People magazine or to, you know, the Joe Rogans, the Manosphere, the Man podcast, the stuff that is like ostensibly entertainment, but then people are also getting their news. I'll use another example of these focus groups that I got access to that were actually not Bulwark. In these focus groups, there were these men who had support. They were Arizona voters and they had supported Donald Trump in November. And previously to that, I believe they were like Joe Biden voters, Democratic voters in the past. And all of them were just saying like, I don't trust the media. And they were saying stuff like, I consider CNN to be the same as Fox News. And then without fail, all of them had heard about Kilmar Abrego-Garcia being wrongly sent by the administration to El Salvador. So the stories are breaking through. They may not trust the traditional media outlets, but the stories are breaking through. And I think that that definitely is something to look at and something that could hurt the Trump administration in the future.
Well, one of the other places that you write about where these kinds of stories are seemingly breaking through is in the area of sports broadcasts. You reference, for example, a Pablo Torre podcast where they spent an hour talking about issues like this. And I wonder if there's sort of a balance here, because, you know, you hear the idea, and you've talked about it, of sort of these non-traditional outlets, these non-news outlets talking about stories like this. But then there's also sort of the, you know, the shut up and dribble kind of argument where, or from viewers or listeners, that sports are kind of the escape from everything else you might be hearing about on CNN or on the Joe Rogan Experience, anything like that. What's the balance there between especially sports folks talking about these issues while still serving as maybe a way to get away from some of these issues?
It's a fascinating dynamic you're talking about. I mean, you know, for me, I love sort of like the fandom, the Marvel, the Star Wars stuff. And when I'm stepping away from news, I want to be able to have like my place where I can just sort of enjoy and just kind of have some mindless entertainment. And along those same lines, when you look at sports, when you hear this stuff like shut up and dribble, or you say leave, or you see comments online about leave politics out of sports, sports has always been one of the front lines for political conversation, you know, including things like Jackie Robinson breaking into baseball and stuff that reflects what's going on in our society. So, you know, I think that it's ultimately, you if you have an audience, I think Pablo Torre in the story tells me that he learned being a magazine writer that people may start reading your story because they like the team you're talking about or the player, but they're going to finish your story because they something resonates with them and something touches them, and they find that they're learning something interesting. So I think along those lines, right, if somebody like a Pablo Torre or sports you know, focused journalists are interested in looking at the aspect of a, you know, former undersized goalkeeper who had a Real Madrid tattoo, and that now is being used as the basis to disappear him into El Salvador, or to say that he's a gang member because he has like a soccer ball and a crown tattoo. I mean, you know, it sort of, I think he mentioned it, and it's something that I keep coming back to in this immigration space of like the absurdity of some of these things. And oftentimes parody and absurdity can elevate a story, and maybe you're not going to read it in the Washington Post, but you'll see it in one of the platforms you trust, one of the messengers you trust, and it'll resonate with you.
What do you see the future holding in terms of some of these non-traditional media outlets influencing political outcomes and political actions? I mean, we hear so many people referring to the 2024 election as the podcast election. Is like, is this sort of the new normal in your mind?
I think a lot of times political folks, campaign folks make mistakes when they try to, you know, sort of run the last election. 2028 will not be under the all the things that happened in 2024. Different issues will rise to the forefront. And I've talked to Democrats, and I'm just like, if they're still talking about podcasts in August of 2028, they're in trouble. You know, they need to sort of have platforms that people, you know, messengers that people trust, platforms that people trust, and get out of their bubbles. And so I think that that's going to be really important. You know, once people sort of find you interesting and they're hearing your human story, and then you can say, oh, hey, by the way, here's what's going on in politics that you should be paying attention to.
Adrian Carrasquillo is the author of the Huddled Masses newsletter at The Bulwark. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Finally today, as an expression of my own fandom, and continuing on our theme of finding community in non-traditional media, not to mention blurring the lines between fiction and reality, I am excited to share a conversation I had recently with the co-creator and star of one of my favorite TV shows. It's an HBO series called Somebody Somewhere, and it stars Bridget Everett, who just so happens to be a graduate of ASU. Prior to her television career, Everett was a cult favorite cabaret singer in New York City, where she is renowned for her over-the-top performances of super explicit, bawdy musical comedy. But Somebody Somewhere introduced the world to a more nuanced version of Everett. The series is inspired by her life. She grew up in Manhattan, Kansas, and in the show, she plays a character named Sam Miller, a messy, talented, tortured soul who moves home to Manhattan after the death of one of her sisters. The story follows Sam's attempt to readjust to small-town life, get her own life on track, and reconnect with her singing voice. It is funny and tender and awkward and profound, and in 2023, it won a Peabody Award. The awards committee specifically referenced Somebody Somewhere's, quote, combination of pathos and hilarity. I spoke to Bridget Everett last week, and I was particularly interested in how she and the writers of the series found that delicate balance.
I wanted something that was a reflection of the way I see my life, like with my friends. You know, you laugh, you cry, you know, you fart, all of it.
Yes, yes. Well, that makes me think of a number of scenes where basically those exact things happen.
Oh my God, it was just happening with my friends last night in real life.
Can I ask what felt important to you about capturing that kind of dynamic? Did you feel like it was missing from other things that you watch?
Well, I don't know. I just felt like we didn't focus so much on like a big story engine and a big drive. It was more about the moments between people. And so anytime anything felt like it was there just for a laugh or that wasn't meaningful, we just took it out. So our, you know, in our first season, our episodes were kind of short because we just cut everything out. You know, we just wanted it. We wanted everything in there to mean something and to feel like you were kind of sitting in a room and just observing the people there, if that makes any sense.
That does make sense. That does make sense. And it makes me think about one of, I'm sure, the most famous or maybe infamous scenes in the whole show, which is the scene where your character, Sam Miller, and Jeff Hiller's character, Joel, are both having some intestinal distress and on the phone with each other on your respective toilets. It's so gross, but it also feels like this is why these characters love each other, because they can share literally everything. And it felt like an extreme but completely honest way of illustrating that.
Yeah. It just reminded me of a kind of intimacy that you crave, like, and that Sam would really want to have with somebody, mm-hmm. You know, that you can only do something like that with one special person in the world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think for me, that's one of the things that works so well about it, is that it doesn't feel like it's there in a, can you believe we put this on a screen, but more like, yeah. This is the way people who really trust each other interact.
Nothing in the show is like, wouldn't it be wild if we did this? It's more a lot of times stuff that's happened in my life or some version of what kind of happened in my life.
Yeah.
With my sister when I was little, like she would just sit on the toilet and like show me how to put a tampon in. And I was like, that's sisterhood. And it's, you know, you just see that kind of stuff. And like, I know it's kind of vulgar and maybe base level humor, but to me, it's real life.
Well, one of the other things I love most about the show is that it also sits very heavily in moments of life that are very hard to deal with. Like, I'm thinking of the moment where Sam goes to the doctor, and she hasn't been to the doctor in a long time, and she's sitting there in this gown, and the gown doesn't really fit, and the doctor has just told her, you got to make some big changes in your life.
How about a mammogram?
How about it?
At your age, you should be getting one every year.
Well, I really think I'm fine. I've been in the shower before and kind of, you know, poked around. I haven't felt anything, so I think I'm good.
Look, you can keep throwing up these roadblocks, but if you're not going to look out for yourself, I'm going to look out for you. How's that sound?
It sounds good.
Good. I'll give you a call when your blood work and your x-ray is back. In the meantime, Samantha, I'd like you to work on your lifestyle choices.
And then the doctor walks out of the room and the camera just sits there staring at Sam for a little while. And she's like processing all of that.
Because I think those moments are, you know, I've been to the doctor and like I have the gown that doesn't go over my big old beaver tails, you know, and like I'm sitting there but, you know, Sam in that moment, it's like she doesn't care enough about herself to take care of herself. Mm. It's hard to hear it. And I think it's important to kind of sit with the person after that, because I like to see the landmine exploding on them or in them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that makes me think about a line from the show that just made me like vibrate with recognition is when she finally gets up the nerve to go for a walk with Iceland, who is this character who is renting she and her sister's father's house and who Sam has developed these feelings for. And Sam is making all these self-deprecating jokes. And Iceland just looks at her and says, I don't like the way you put yourself down. And you can see that it, I don't know, like destroys Sam to be that recognized.
Yeah, it's so true. And, you know, like Dari, the actor, like didn't really want to say that line because I think he thought it was sort of direct or something. But I was like, it really hit me. Like it hit me in my heart. I was like, and that has to be in there because I remember when he looked at me and he said it, it was like, I was like, oh my God, is this Sam that's being affected right now or Bridget? Because that is like, oh my God.
Wow.
It was a good moment for Sam to hear and Bridget.
Well, can I ask you a little bit about that? Because we meet a lot of characters in Sam's life in Kansas, whether it's Joel, who we have talked about, who's her friend who she can have intestinal distress with on the phone, or Brad, Joel's boyfriend, or Fred Rococo, who is this like gender nonconforming person who lives in the town. Less intelligent shows would put characters like that in a town in the Midwest and have a lot of the action of the series be about them being seen as different and having to navigate that difference. And something that I think is really beautiful that the show does is it just shows us their day-to-day life. They have natural community with each other. They've all found each other already. And it's less about them finding community in an unlikely place and more about them confronting the things about themselves that are really hard to deal with no matter who you are.
Well, it was what would happen if I didn't move to New York, what my life like look like if I had stayed in Kansas or something, because I'm from there. And I think, you know, these are the kinds of friends that I have in New York. And I think these are the kinds of friends I would have if I stuck around Manhattan, Kansas. And also, you know, if you're trans or something living in a smaller town, like there are going to be some challenges, right? Like,
right.
Or anywhere these days, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It feels like that's understood, you know, like, so I would rather just see how people live and how they connect with other people and just, you know, and assume that those things exist, but that that's not the story that we want to tell. There's so much that's about people's trauma because of who they are. And it's probably in some ways a little more political to do something that's just about their day-to-day lives. Because to me, these are all our friends, our neighbors, our community. What's the big deal? Who they love, you know, or how they live. Like, we're all in this together.
Yeah. Well, as you were saying that, it made me think the character whose way that they express themselves in the world gets put to the test the most is Trisha, Sam's sister. And for the first maybe half of the show is, she thinks, doing a good job of performing the kind of mainstream life of like owning a small business in a small town, being a mom, kind of coloring inside the lines. And then her reality gets blown up and she ends up stepping into this much truer version of herself. And
yeah,
so it's kind of like the person who's making the most conventional choices that ends up having the most unconventional journey.
Yeah. And I love that. And that's on purpose because in my way, you know, I had friends when I would bring some, you know, a friend home from New York who, you know, I brought my friend home who was gay, and like another friend of mine said, you know, love the sinner, hate the sin. And so that's in the show in the pilot episode. And I'm like, are you serious? Like, is this how you talk about people? Like you, we just had a wonderful night together. We were all hanging out. And anyway, so I think it's important for that person, the love the sinner, hate the sin, the person that's going to say that, that's the person who needs to do the growth. And that's the person who needs to change.
Well, Bridget Everett is the star and executive producer of Somebody Somewhere on Max. Bridget, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you for having me. And, you know, tell your friends to watch the show. I hope you enjoy it.
I've never been west of the Kansas state line. I've stayed home all my life and I've worked all the time, but I'm a rover at heart.
You know, there are some things you can only say, do, and talk about with some people. And here at the show, we are grateful for the chance to talk with all of you on the radio every morning. Thank you for listening. Let's do it again tomorrow, shall we? For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. We'll talk to you then.
For me, 'cause I'm a rover at heart, and I'm bound to go to see if it's true what I seen in that show. Those cattle, those cowboys, that roping was fine.
That's it for this episode of the Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.